Welcome to Whiskey Cast, the Cask Strength podcast featuring news and interviews from the world of whiskey. I'm Mark Gillespie. This is episode number 233 for January 3rd, 2010. Coming up in a few minutes.
It is a tiny subject, but as with any tiny subject, the more you look into it, the more you find out and the more exciting it becomes.
That's Chris Bunting, an English expat living in Japan and author of the leading blog on Japanese whiskies, Nunjata.com. Japanese malts have been dominating whiskey competitions around the world for the last several years, and we'll get some of Chris's insights in a few minutes, along with the calendar of events, the emails of the week, and the What I'm Tasting This Week department. First off, let's look at the news. There are a couple of new whiskeys to mention this week. Gordon & McPhail has unleashed a couple of Kalila casks for the new year. Both are bottled at 45% ABV. One was finished in a Madeira wine cask for 20 months, while the other one was finished in a port cask for 20 months. I received samples of both earlier this weekend. I'll have tasting notes for them on the next episode. The Glenrothes will be sending its 1994 vintage to the U.S. in the new year. It's been available in other global markets for a while now and will replace the 1991 vintage as supplies run out. If you got a TomTom navigation system for Christmas and want to make it the ultimate whiskey geek's toy, White & Mackay is making it possible. Richard Patterson went into a recording studio and laid down the audio tracks for TomTom systems, and you can download the package from the White & Mackay website. Here's an example, complete with responsible drinking advice.
You've arrived at your destination. If drinking, get a taxi home.
Now, it being the holidays and all, I had some spare time on my hands. And since the White & Mackay folks were kind enough to send me all of Richard's audio, I couldn't resist having some fun. Let's listen now to the Richard Patterson remix.
You turn. Turn sharply right. Join the motorway. Go straight on. Don't drink and drive. First exit, 200 yards, meter, yards, meter, 100, 80, 50. At the end of the road, don't drink and drive.
Again, if you have a TomTom, you can download the Richard Patterson audio package at the White & Mackay website. The Richard Patterson remix will not be found there. Let's check the inbox for the emails of the week. Jeff Lewin in Calumet, Michigan emailed to say he liked the last episode where we focused on bourbons. He prefers bourbon to scotch for its value. Since Michigan has minimum pricing laws, he can get a bottle of Buffalo Trace for about the same price as a bottle of his usual famous Grouse, and Russell's Reserve is cheaper than his usual bottle of Glenlivet. Jeff asks for more coverage on bourbons and Irish whiskeys, and I'll do my best to make that happen this year, Jeff. Aaron Gallagher in Murfreesboro, Tennessee, just discovered WhiskeyCast as he was getting ready for his Christmas vacation in Florida. He writes, I loaded up the most recent episodes, starting with the October 10th episode, when Jim Murray stated that Sazerac 18-year-old was his top pick for his 2010 Whiskey Bible. I knew I was going to be a devoted follower of this podcast. Aaron enjoys the regular Sazerac rye along with Old Overholt, and he's upset that he can't have liquor shipped to him legally in Tennessee because of state law. He wants to know if there are any groups trying to get the law changed in his state. I don't know of any groups active in Tennessee, but if there is a listener that does, please email me and I'll pass your contact information on to Aaron. I also want to thank everyone who posted holiday greetings on the WhiskeyCast Facebook page, and Matt Bechtel passed along some comments on the last episode's interview with Devin Zell of BourbonDrinker.com. Devin mentioned how he and some other folks like to search for out-of-circulation bourbons. Matt wrote, I enjoyed your podcast this week with its focus on bourbon and thought I'd let you in on a little find of my own. While searching the shelves of a local liquor store, I found two dust-covered bottles of Wild Turkey Russell's Reserve in the original 101 proof, behind all the new 90 proof bottles. I'm glad the employees didn't think rotating stock was important. Good advice, Matt, and thanks for sharing it with us. If you have a question or a comment, my email address is comments@whiskeycast.com. Time now for the calendar of events brought to you by Laphroaig. Speaking of Jimmy Russell, he'll be the guest of honor at the monthly Distillers Dinner at Bourbon's Bistro in Louisville on January 25th. Dr. Bill Lumsden of Glenmorangie and Ardbeg fame will be making several stops in the northeastern U.S. later this month. He'll be at Julio's Liquors in Westboro, Massachusetts on the 29th, a couple of days after Julio's unveils the Balvenie single cask that owner Ryan Maloney told us about in episode 227 last October. I'll have more details on Bill Lumsden's tour stops as they're available. McTeers in Glasgow will hold its next auction of rare whiskies on February 3rd, and there will be dueling whiskey festivals in Belgium the weekend of February 5th through the 7th. The International Malt Whiskey Festival takes place in Ghent, while Whiskey Live Belgium will be held in Spa. Finally, don't forget about the live webcast of Whiskey Cast on January 23rd from the Victoria Whiskey Festival. It's just 3 weeks away. You'll find a complete calendar of events at the WhiskeyCast website, and it's brought to you by Laphroaig. Just click on the Laphroaig banner at the WhiskeyCast website to become a friend of Laphroaig and claim your own square foot of Islay. Japanese whiskeys took 3 of the 7 gold medals in the recent Malt Maniacs competition and have been a fixture in whiskey contests around the world for the last several years. There are very few people who have the base of knowledge that Chris Bunting does on Japanese whiskeys. He's an Englishman living in Japan and is responsible for the Nanjata.com blog.
It started really as a personal hobby and still is. Basically kind of surprised to find there was such a thing as Japanese whiskey. I'd moved over here, you know, just to do with personal reasons, and was walking around a supermarket with my son and found a bottle of single malt Japanese whiskey. And I was rather, at that stage, rather less informed about whiskey than maybe I am now. So I hadn't heard all the fuss about Japanese whiskey, which I think goes back to about 2001.
How long ago was this?
It's only about 4 years ago.
Okay.
So it's certainly after, you know, it's well after, you know, people who knew about whiskey were making it, you know, starting to say Japanese whiskey was very, you know, was to be looked at. But anyway, so I had my little personal discovery of these bottles in my local supermarket. And at the time I was living in a rather rural part of Japan, so the sort of alcohol I had available to me was quite limited, so I tried them and they tasted good. So anyway, and I looked for more information and didn't find much on the internet, and decided that whatever I did find out, I might as well post up for other people to read about.
Now, there are a lot of whiskeys that are made in Japan that the rest of us never get to see, right?
That's right. In fact, the vast majority of whiskey that's made in Japan is never makes it outside Japan, except from, I suppose, in people's hand luggage, if they come over here. Hibiki, which is Suntory's premium blended whiskey, does have, I understand, some exposure abroad. But apart from that, and maybe one or two of Nikka's premium blends, you don't see any of the blended whiskey, which is the large majority of the market over here, just as it is elsewhere. So yes, the answer to your question is yes, there's huge amounts of whiskey that's not tasted abroad. And a lot of it is mass market whiskey. It's not premium, and it's not aimed at a premium market. And to be honest, is really designed to be drunk, mixed with other things, in mizuwari, which is a water and ice sort of mix, or things like this. So it's not terribly high quality, some of the cheaper stuff.
But the premium stuff that's there tends to be very good in comparison to other whiskeys from around the world.
That's right. I think that's well accepted now, isn't it? I think basically what's happened, the broad sort of shape of what's happened, is in the 70s and 80s, Japan had a huge whiskey market. And in the 70s to 80s also, the capacity to meet that whiskey market was built up, you know, so that they actually built a very large whiskey industry to meet the domestic demand. There was, and really still is, not much of an export market for Japanese whiskey. It's generally consumed in Japan. And in the 70s and 80s, the fact was that it was very difficult and very expensive to get foreign whiskey because of the unfair trading arrangements that the Japanese government ran at that time. So they have these huge industries that were basically originally designed to meet sort of mass market demand for sort of fairly cheaper end whiskies. But the market has declined significantly. And I think the big makers are realizing that in order to survive, they have to produce top quality whiskey. And that's their sort of the background story to why Japanese whiskey is so good when they're trying to make a premium product.
Give us an example of some of the premium end whiskeys that you're able to get in Japan that the rest of us would not be able to find.
let me think. Well, to be honest, I'm probably less informed than you are about how easy it is to get Japanese whiskey in the States, which is where you're based. Is that right?
Basically, we get the Suntory Yamazaki 12, the Yamazaki 18, and just now starting to get the Hibiki 12 in. And they did let us have one cask of Yamazaki 1984.
Right.
Other than that,
we don't get Nikka.
Yeah, it's wonderful stuff, but we don't get Nikka, we don't get Yoichi, we don't get anything else, any of the other creative whiskeys that are made over there. So it really is...
From that account, then, you don't get 90% of the top quality, you know, whiskey that comes from Japan, because Nikka is the equal of Suntory in terms of its single malt whiskeys. So I don't, you know, they're both, you know, producing excellent whiskeys. And then, as well as that, apart from the two companies, so Suntory have two distilleries. They have Yamazaki and Hakushu. Yamazaki, as from what you just said, Yamazaki seems to be the one that makes it to the States. But Hakushu, you know, makes some very interesting whiskies too. And then you're also missing Yoichi, which is Nikka's oldest and most established distillery, which makes probably some of the more kind of forthright Japanese whiskies that you can get. It's less polite than, say, a Yamazaki usually. And then there's Miyagikyo, which is the Nikka's other top whiskey distillery. And then there's also independent makers, which in many ways I find sort of are my little obsession at the moment. So there's Chichibu, which I think you would know about, which is this very small craft distillery that's opened a couple of years ago and is sort of within a year or so of producing its first sort of genuine whiskey. And the same company that produces Chichibu produces Ichiro's Malts whiskeys, which are from a previous distillery that went bankrupt but still made some excellent whiskey.
Those are the ones that people would see with playing card type labels and
that's right,
in that
yes.
format.
Ichiro's Malt, yes, and they have the Queen of Hearts or the Ace of Spades, and some of that stuff is just fantastic.
And we should note that for our European listeners, the European market gets a lot more of these whiskeys than North America does.
That's right, and the reason for that is I don't know. I'm obviously just sort of commenting on it, but I did talk to Mike Miyamoto, who is the distillery manager at Yamazaki, and I was sort of complaining on your behalf that.
Thank you.
That some of the.
I've also complained to Mike as well about it.
Yes, well, I'm sure he's sick and tired of hearing about it, and I don't know what his response to you was, but his response to me was that it's not really their fault. They want to get it out there, but the American market is extremely difficult to export to. I think there's all sorts of issues about bottle sizes, but also I think originally at one stage they had tried to export Hakushu into America and had actually been met with a sort of a bureaucratic refusal to acknowledge that Japan made single malt whiskey. And so it was very difficult. So they weren't going to be able to label it as single malt whiskey.
Which was immediately rebuffed because the label Yamazaki is single malt whiskey. So
yes,
they've gotten around
that. So that's what he said. And what he said, did they? Yes. But I think that still affects their mentality because I think, you know, unless they, I think they, maybe they know what they're, what's going to happen when you export to Europe. So they're more prepared to do it. Having said that, the other reason why Europe's so good is they have these two independent importers, number one drinks company and also Maison du Whisky, which are actually bringing a lot of the whisky to people, and I think are doing a lot of work with companies like Nikka to actually get the stuff on a boat.
I know when I was at Whiskey Live Paris a little over a year ago, the folks at La Maison de Whiskey had really done a wonderful job evangelizing on behalf of Japanese whiskey in at least the French market, and I would gather throughout the wider European market as well.
That's right. They're just phenomenally good at, just making... Basically, some of the whiskeys that they are... your original question to me is what Japanese whiskeys... can we get over here that you can't get in America? But there are actually whiskies available in Europe which are very difficult to get hold of in Japan. so some of the importers into Europe are sort of outperforming themselves. I also think that was interesting this year. Looking back on this year, there was the Yamazaki, the new the Hakushu. No, the Hibiki 12, is that right?
Yes.
One of the whiskies, anyway, was being imported to America before it was ever released in Japan. So maybe things will change.
I'm hoping so because the Hibiki 12 was very good, and it really is an example of what a good Japanese blended whiskey can taste like, and it compares very favorably, just as the single malts do, with the best of Scotland and America and Canada and the rest of the world.
I think that's right, and I think the situation we've got to now is that it's just not that surprising anymore. The news value of Japanese whiskey being very good, I think, over the next couple of years is going to subside, and we'll just start to see it as another whiskey-producing country. And look to other places to be surprised by their whiskey from.
Now, in your dealings in Japan and visiting some of the whiskey bars and the whiskey shops, do the Japanese whiskeys get preference, or are they more in demand than the imported whiskeys among Japanese?
Oh, it's very. If we're talking about if you're talking about the bars, it's quite conservative. There are these phenomenal bars, which have been described to me as basically, if you want to come and drink whiskey and really, have a phenomenal range of whiskey to try from all over the world, you really need to come to Tokyo or Osaka rather than Edinburgh or New York. And so they are quite conservative. So the emphasis is definitely mainly on Scotch whiskies, and then they'll have a small section of Japanese whiskies. There's a few exceptions to that. There's one particular bar in Shinjuku, just down the road from me, which specializes entirely in Japanese whiskey.
What other bars could you recommend for somebody visiting Tokyo who would want to see one of these bars?
The one I've just mentioned, Zoetrope. Is in Shinjuku, near just right next to the station. I would definitely recommend that. He's got, I would say, more than 200 Japanese whiskies, and he also has Japanese rums and Japanese meads and all Japanese beers, all sorts of things. But that's great fun, and that has a nice sort of modern atmosphere. It's not so, traditionally Scottish or sort of laden down with ideas of what whiskey should be, so that's quite fun. As far as whiskey bars are concerned, a few are running through my head. Speyside Way is a nice one, quite a pub-like atmosphere. That's again in Tokyo. And if you really want to know about the best Japanese bars, you need to buy my book that will be coming out next year.
Tell me more about the book. I did not know you were writing it.
Right. I've written it's basically half a bar guide. So there are about 100 bars in there of all types, not just whiskey. I have a chapter on shochu bars, a chapter on sake bars, a chapter on awamori, which is the spirit from the southern island of Okinawa, beer bars, wine bars, etc. But it's also half of it is going to be, I think, probably the best introduction to Japanese alcohol of all types and the history of Japanese alcohol that will be available in English. So I've gone quite, deeply into the history of not just Japanese whiskey, but the history of distilled alcohol in Japan. You know, both shochu is the indigenous distilled spirit, and awamori is the indigenous distilled spirit from Okinawa, which is the southern island. And so I've gone quite deeply into that history, and then the whiskey story really takes up from that, and is a continuation of that tradition, in my opinion.
When will your book be out?
Well, it's at the publishers now. It'll be out in spring or summer. I haven't got a final date from them yet.
If somebody's flying through Tokyo, just in transit,
yeah.
How's the market at the duty-free shops? Uh-huh. Are you able to find an interesting selection of the Japanese whiskeys at the duty-free shops, for instance?
Yeah, if you're going through Narita, which is the main one I've been through, so that's really the one I'll talk about. They have a reasonable selection. If you're happy with the products of the two main producers, which is Suntory and Nikka, they also sometimes have products of a distillery called Karuizawa, which is owned by Kirin, which is another large company. You're not going to get any of the independent stuff I talked about earlier, the Ichiro's Malts, Shichibu Distillery. You're not going to get I didn't get a chance to talk about Egashima, which is another tiny little producer that I'm kind of interested in at the moment. But the main makers are there, and it's quite a good selection and quite good prices. The main thing to be careful of is if you're transiting through a country which has restrictions on hand luggage and things, make sure you don't get it taken off you. So if you change, for instance, in some countries, you won't be allowed to take the bottle onto the plane. So check your ticket.
Where else can you suggest that people get information? What else on the blog, for instance, that people would want to know about Japanese whiskeys?
Sorry, could you repeat? I'm not sure I understood the question.
Sure.
Yeah.
What all is on nanjata.com that people can learn from reading your blog?
What could they learn from reading my blog?
Yes.
How it's possible for a man to get ridiculously obsessed by one very small subject is the first thing they'll learn. but the history of Japanese whiskey is just phenomenal. It's just a lovely story. There's a few articles on there about how it developed. It sort of comes from. It mirrors the modern history of Japan. You know, Japan is open to the world in 1868, I think, and there's this rush of all technology coming in and all foreign ideas. And one of those ideas was whiskey. It started almost concurrently with the opening of the country by your lot, by Commodore Perry and his black ships, because they brought whiskey as a gift for the emperor. I don't think any of it actually got to the emperor. I think it was all drunk by the emperor's officials. But then there's all these attempts in the Meiji period to sort of simulate whiskey in sort of chemistry labs, and then eventually Taketsuru, who's the sort of founding father of the Japanese whiskey industry, rather bravely gets on a ship, goes to Scotland in 1919, and learns about whiskey in the Scottish distilleries, and also gets falls in love, comes back with a Scottish bride, Rita Taketsuru, who lives the rest of her life, spanning a world war with her home country in Japan. It's just a wonderful story, really. There's endless. I think it is a tiny subject, but as with any tiny subject, the more you look into it, the more you find out, and the more exciting it becomes.
Of course, there's a link to Nonjata at the WhiskeyCast website, and I'll let you know when Chris's book becomes available. If you'd like to know even more, Dave Broom has written several articles for Whiskey Magazine on Japanese distilleries, and Ulf Buxrud's award-winning book on Japanese whiskey is available at the WhiskeyCast store, powered by Amazon.com. You can also listen to my interviews with Mike Miyamoto of Yamazaki in episode 123 and episode 165, where I also talked with Nika's Kamiguchi Naofumi about his whiskies. Let's start off the What I'm Tasting This Week department with what is probably the most widely available Japanese single malt. Suntory's Yamazaki 12-year-old has a spicy and woody nose, with hints of pepper and a touch of malt. The taste is peppery with an underlying caramel candy sweetness and a hint of molasses. The finish is long and spicy with hints of pepper as well. It's a well-balanced malt that I almost always have a bottle of, and I'm scoring the Yamazaki 12 a 90. We heard from Bal Blair master distiller John McDonald in episode 226 about Inverhouse's plans to export Bal Blair to the U.S. in 2010. I tasted the 1991 vintage Bal Blair this week. The nose is light, dry, and malty, with notes of pears and green apples. The taste starts off tart, with a spiciness that builds gradually to a blast of cinnamon and hazelnut. The finish has hints of dark chocolate and a lemony tartness. And I'm giving the Bal Blair 1991 a 91. A couple of weeks ago, I tasted three Tomaten single malts. This week, I tasted an independent bottling of 19-year-old Tomaten from the Master of Malt. It's a cask strength 57.6% ABV, but has no alcohol burn on the nose. Just a great maltiness with notes of dried grass, peaches, and pears. The taste redefines thick. It's almost oily with intense malt and a hint of hazelnut, and the maltiness continues on the finish with a hint of oak. This Tomaten is smooth and consistent from nose to finish. The Master of Malt has a masterful bottling here. I'm scoring it a 96. I also tasted several other Master of Malt bottlings this week. You'll find my notes for them on the WhiskeyCast website, along with links to the WhiskeyCast Facebook page and my Twitter feed, the calendar of events, the WhiskeyCast store, and a complete archive of past episodes. The address is www.whiskeycast.com, and my email address is comments@whiskeycast.com. I'd love to hear from you. WhiskeyCast is a production of Cask Strength Media, copyright 2010, and comes to you from the charming, yet regrettably dry town of Haddonfield, New Jersey. I'm Mark Gillespie, reminding you that when you drink, please drink responsibly. Thanks for listening.
End of the road.